It's Friday, June 16th, 1989. This is Hearing Room C, the Senate Labor Committee.
Call the Senate Labor Committee to order, and looking out in the audience, I see the distinguished representative from Beaver Creek has graced our committee with his presence. We'll call the Honorable Bob Shipwreck forward, and trumpets and flourishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need that today.
Ruffles.
Ruffles and flourishes. Ruffles and flourishes. Thank you.
Kind of tired for some reason.
Hey.
For the record, I'm State Representative Bob Shipwreck, House District 23, Clackamas County. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have in front of us today a House Bill 2348, which makes a significant technical change in the way workers' compensation is both purchased and administered in the state of Oregon. During the last interim, it was my privilege to be allowed to speak to a couple different national associations, NCCI being one of them that sets the rates, NCSL, which is our state legislative association. And I've got to know many of the insurance people nationally that underwrite workers' compensation across the country. At those events, I've often asked them, why don't you write insurance in Oregon? And consistently, I got back the same answer. It's because of your designated adjuster rule. And I...
You said, oh, yeah,
sure. You're right.
I recognize.
Okay. Not understanding what that was, I brought it up to the department during the interim, and then I ran across it in a personal situation. During the interim, I had got a hold of several trade associations who were looking at some group insurance for workers' comp purposes. We met with a service contractor in Portland on two occasions. And once again, we ran up against this designated adjuster rule. And what the rule is, and we're one of two states in the country that have this rule. And basically what it says is that if you're going to do workers' comp insurance in Oregon, you have to do it all at one location. So a carrier that wished to come into Oregon would have to have a significant investment in both capital, buildings, personnel, etc. In other words, they can't contract out some of the services that they need to have to provide workers' compensation. In Oregon, we do have, in fact, I believe the number is 33 different service contractors existing today. Many of these work for self-insured employers, and we've got representatives of those companies here today who will explain the more finer details of this situation. In the House, we worked on this bill with the cooperation that I appreciated with the department so that the bill is workable. We are going to limit the number of locations that any one insurer can have to 8 at any one time. And for self-insureds, I believe it's 3. Again, the self-insureds currently do this. They contract with a service contractor for claims handling, loss control, whatever. The significance of the legislation is twofold. One, you have professional companies within the state that are quite well qualified to, for instance, administer claims, handle claims. They do a good job of it. Testimony on the House side says, in fact, they probably do a better job than some of the carriers do as far as losses. It injects a good old American principle called competition into the Oregon workers' comp system. It will give both private carriers safe and as well as the self-insureds an option to shop around for those people to do a better job at a lower cost. And we also have, was told to me that passage of the bill would in fact open up the market substantially, and we are looking at other companies perhaps coming into Oregon and writing
workers' comp insurance. I want to digress just a little bit as to why I was meeting with some various trade associations during the summer and why competition is, in fact, necessary. Essentially, in Oregon today, we have, for all intents and purposes, two insurance companies writing workers' compensation insurance. One's the state fund, the other is a large privately owned company headquartered in Portland. These trade associations were told that they could not get a group policy from either of these companies, and that in fact, with passage of the bill, we expect these other companies will come in and provide these types of not only group policies but also individual policies to businesses who would like another option instead of being, frankly, left to either one company or the other. And so in that respect, it would be significant. As I mentioned, there are people here who are much more better informed of the day-to-day problems of the designated adjuster rule, and leave it for them to go into the finer points, as I said. But that's conceptually what this bill does. It creates more competition. We'll have some more companies come in. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think ultimately this can result in some lower rates in this state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gretzky.
Representative Shiprock, as somebody who has done a lot of personal injury work, I didn't realize that this wasn't already happening, and certainly the way it's done in other areas other than workers' comp.
Mm-hmm.
So my question would be, why did we wait till now to do this, and why was it set up that way in the first place, if you know?
The history on the House side was Mr. Young testified. Apparently the legislature made this rule in 1975 for twofold. One was a matter of convenience. It's very easy for the state to audit when business is conducted at one address. Very simple for the state. Second reason was a belief that if you had operations in various locations, it would be difficult for employers to know where, in fact, their claim was or where their policy was. We discussed that and said that this is still the ultimate responsibility of the carrier, that they have, in fact, to let the employer and employee know where, in fact, the claims are being handled at.
Any other reasons?
It was bizarre, Representative Grinsky. When I mentioned during the interim, I talked to the department. A lot of people really, frankly, didn't know why it was done. And Mr. Young did a little research on it.
Thanks.
That was the answer I got.
Is there anybody opposing this thing?
Nope. The department's going to speak. Sure. Senator Shoemaker.
Bob, a couple of questions looking over the bill. I don't understand just upon reading it why we have these two provisions into it. One is that the insurer may not have more than 8 locations at any one time where claims are processed mm-hmm. or records are maintained. You know, what are the reasons for that?
We didn't want to, yes, pardon me, Senator Shoemaker, you have to put a number somewhere.
Why?
Well,
otherwise it'd keep 50 or 100.
Well, yeah. Conceptually you could, but to be reasonable, it was an accommodation for the department that if you're one carrier, we felt 8 locations was enough. The department felt that they could still do a very adequate job of auditing. And that's important at 8 locations. And we expand the current rule from 1 to 3 for self-insureds. But it was our feeling you had to put a limit somewhere. And we, as a compromise for all the parties, came up with 8 and 3.
What was the reason that insurer may not enter into a service agreement with one of its insureds unless the insured has service contracts with other insurers?
I talked with the House counsel about that because I wasn't clear on that. Do you want me to?
I can answer. Oh. You can probably answer it better. No, go ahead, Annette.
Oh, no. It doesn't matter. I just it caught me off guard in terms of wondering what that meant exactly. The issue was they didn't want an insurer to be able to just say, use Fred Meyer's as an example, say insurer go contract with Fred Meyer's to service Fred Meyer's owned account. So Fred Meyer, if he were to contract with them, they would have to also be contracting with other insurers. So just to avoid the issue of they might be able to just have a contract with
them. Bread. They just adjust their own accounts.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Sure. In other words, if Fred Meyer was an adjuster?
Well, if Fred Meyer was the insurer's insured, you could just contract with them and have a service agreement with them. This makes it that Fred Meyer would also have to have a service
agreement. If Fred Meyer would adjust its own, it would adjust its own claims then.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
okay. We don't want that.
Unless they are in the business of adjusting claims and thus prove that by having it with somebody else
right.
as well. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I guess that makes sense.
Could have done it. Mm-hmm. Saying that.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Young, you want to come and visit with us?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Larry Young, manager of the compliance section of the Workers' Compensation Division. You have my written testimony before you. I will not read that because I'm sure you can read it faster than I can read it out loud. The bill amends ORS 731-475, and it was put into law in 1975 at our request, basically because prior to that time, when we were trying to monitor who was processing claim, how was the claim was being processed, the claims were being processed outside of the state of Oregon, in Connecticut, New York, wherever there was an insurance company, and we have a complaint about a time list of time loss payment or the worker not getting his payments or who the bill was supposed to be sent to, and it would take days in order to find who was processing the claim and who was responsible for processing the claim. So the real issue in 731 is the fact that they have to have an in-state location. And then we say in lieu of coming into the state yourself, you can use a service company if you want to. By rule, we've been allowing more than one location for insurers. And what this basically does is just say they can have more than one service company. Now, Oregon is a little bit unique in as far as some of our requirements, such as the cents per day money, that's different assessments. We have to audit the insurance companies and the insureds. And we also have our performance audits. So we've limited the locations because if you're going to say how an insurer is doing with it, on their, say, the retroactive reserve claims, where they increase the benefits of payments out, you could have X number of locations. We'd have to go to verify those audits. If they have unlimited number of locations in the state of Oregon or service companies, then in order to verify or do actual audits of how the retroactive reserve benefits were done, we'd have to go to each one of those locations or have the claims sent or whatever. So this is basically why we've tried to limit it. And on the House side, we agreed with the 8 locations, so we'd have a definitive number of possible locations. We don't believe there'll be that many. It went to Ways and Means. We projected probably the max 25 additional locations per year for the next 3 years, and then leveling off. So we're in agreement with the bill at this time, Mr. Chairman. And I'll be happy to answer any further questions.
Questions?
Is there anybody else scheduled?
No, I want to know whether there's anyone else that wanted to testify on 2348.
I think I see a motion.
I think so.
I see Mr. Douglas here. Do you want
to?
I was wanting to know whether you wanted to tell us about it or whether we wanted. Oh, yes, indeed. I'm sorry, Mr. Douglas. You had signed up ahead of Mr. Young. I hadn't seen your name there. You want to tell us about it or you want to see the bill go out?
I'll just wait and see the bill.
All right. The chair would move 2348 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Grinsky?
Aye.
Senator Howe?
Aye.
Senator Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Chairman Carroll.
Aye. Motion passes. Good. 2196. We got, we have heard all of our testimony on that. Is that right?
I believe so.
Good.
You might ask.
Okay, we've got a significant set of amendments to 2196.
85.
Yep. Let's start at the top there. Ms. Talbot, you want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, before we get into this one, while Senator Shoemaker's calling for his file, have that come down or whatever he's doing, alert the rest of the members and alert our friends that are in the room that we're going to be meeting at 8 a.m. on Monday. We'll be taking up Senate Bill 948. 948, which is the one-way workers' compensation system bill, and we'll be taking testimony on that and taking it up for work session. We'd like to start at Monday at 8 and recess from time to time throughout the day and into the early evening, no later than about 7 p.m. on Monday, and then return to the same kind of schedule on Tuesday and Wednesday as needed in order to get a bill together and get it out. Now, the reason for that is that, as you all know, the governor has entered the debate in a significant way with his cohorts, Mr. Kulongoski and Mr. Long, with a whole series of amendments and potential changes in the workers' compensation process in the interests of saving SAFE from sinking into the swamp of red ink it now finds itself in. And he charged us in our caucus, in the Democratic caucus, with the need to find, if not what he had recommended, then the structural reforms that would be necessary to accomplish the same goal. So we're going to investigate that in front of this committee. Now, my personal biases are clear and well known. I think it's intellectually dishonest for us to find some further way to leech 20-30% of the benefit out of the program and transfer that to SAFE as unpaid premiums and call it reform. That's change. And when the people in charge of the system say that still may not be enough on top of what was done in 2900, we ought to pursue another way. So it would be my intention to see whether that would be possible. In addition, I think we ought to take up all of the matters that we have discussed in 2193, 94, 95, and 96, and see whether there are further kinds of adjustments that can be made to those in combination with a new structure in order to create a system that is in balance, in which the premium increases do not continue to skyrocket, in which SAFE finds itself as it is now, the sick man of workers' compensation, with the, you know, with each of the unprofitable accounts out there that there are on its book. We can't sustain that anymore, so we're going to have to go in a different direction. The choices, it seems to me, are sell SAFE now, take a one-time profit, and turn all of the employers over to the tender mercies of the private carriers. Second one is to let SAFE continue to decline until such time as SAFE gets to the point where it must go into receivership and close its books, sell no, write no new insurance. And three is one way. We can't sustain the current process the way it's going. Can't be sustained. There's only a limited amount of time in which the process will continue without collapse. So, with that, I would hope that people would come on Monday, that we would work very diligently, that we would be as serious as we can about the process, that we make as many amendments as we think are legitimately worth making and should be considered, but that we come out with a structural change as opposed to trying to force such draconian measures on the mechanics of the process that it will result in the structural outcome of saving safe. I don't think it's possible. So that's what we're going to be doing on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, from morning and throughout the day, depending on session and the demands of the members, and into the evening. And that we'll continue that process until we come up with a structure that we can live with. And the governor said he wants to have us throw out politics. Politics is no longer a consideration in this process. He likened it to the process taken up by Congressman Rostenkowski and Senator Packwood in the creation of the 86 Tax Reform Act as a method, as an example in which you get to the point where you can no longer protect some of your friends with everyone protecting each of their friends and no one's friends suffering any losses and the system continue to sink. I agree, and it's my intention to see that we can't do that. Failing that, I think the best we can do is make what reasonable changes we can in the mechanics of the process and go home and await either a special session for workers' compensation or await for the collapse of SAFE, whichever comes first. So that's where we're going to be. 2196, we're going to go through the amendments, and I'd like to see whether we can reach some agreement on those. We're going to hold 2193, 95, and 96 for action on 948. Is that the number? 948, which will probably go into one of these bills, and the other bills will then be tied to it. Ms. Talbot.
Mr. Chair, you're going to be taking testimony on this bill?
2196? Yeah. After we go through all the amendments, I'd like to have and offer our friends here the opportunity to comment. Yeah.
Okay, I need to run up and testify to this conference committee of Springers real quick, and I'll run right back.
Was that the
prison
siding?
Yeah.
Tell them to go build one.
I will. Just have to tell them.
Or two.
Or two, as the case may be. Senator Howe.
By your reference to other bills, are you meaning all the comp bills that are before your committee here, or do you want to designate the other bills? You have admitted 2197.
Yes, that's correct. I would assume that if 2197, as my understanding of the consensus of the committee, that 2197, if it advances, or the subject matter which is contained in 2197 is advanced, it will come as the result of a minority report. If a minority report is offered on one of these bills, one or more of these bills, if there is an interest in a minority to do that, I could be proven wrong. It may be turned around
since
and go the other way.
Since 1983, there's been one. I don't know why not.
I can't imagine that there won't be.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, there may not be. I just may agree to everything you say.
Yeah. Right.
Following the testimony that we last had on 2197, which was quite persuasive, I did ask an opportunity to hear testimony on the other side of the issue, and I hope that we would still have it.
I think we can do that.
We would still do that.
Yeah, at some point we'll give people, I think next week we can put that up for a hearing.
Yeah, whoever wishes to testify in favor of 2197, I'd really like, now that I really think I do understand the issues and how it works, I'd like to hear the arguments why that bill is an appropriate bill.
You bet. And we can do that.
Okay, good.
Yeah. All right. Ms. Talbot. Where are we working with? Hand and gross by staff 616?
Yeah. I think that's the best way to go through it. The House, in their, when they amended 2196 and put this bold portion in, was the implementing a new procedure regarding how to schedule a request for hearing. It, as I understand it, is similar to what was previously used prior to House Bill 2900.
Mm-hmm.
In 2900, the legislature implemented a 90-day period in which the request for hearing, that the hearing had to be held. What this would do would go back to
the 2900 approach, leave it the way it is, basically, except in the sense that on lines 10 on page 2, there's an additional amendment. There had been some testimony regarding the ability of parties to be able to reschedule hearings when there were unavoidable circumstances that a postponement needed to happen, and that the current language, extraordinary circumstances, was a little too strict in terms of attorneys who were unable to get doctors' depositions or that sort of thing. This gives a little broader ability of the board to use their discretion to postpone, and that's what it's designed to do.
Could I interrupt? Is it appropriate to comment
there.
As we go
sure.
through?
Yes.
As I read that, it says, unless unavoidable circumstances necessitate a postponement and both parties have agreed to the postponement. I'm not totally comfortable with that. You could have one party really in a box and the other party just keeping them there. I don't think that's fair. Mm-hmm. I think I'd rather leave it to the referee to decide.
Why don't we ask Ms. Kreider to come on up and respond. I would, on both points, the point I would make with the board and the legislative record I would like to leave behind on this is to say that unavoidable circumstances are, in the intent of the legislature, if this language is adopted, are different from those that have been interpreted by the board under the term extraordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that mean unavoidable to be those things in which the interests of the claimant and their representatives are and the board and the process are not served by going to a hearing when the material necessary or the witnesses necessary and the facts have not been revealed or obtained such that the hearing can begin and be concluded and not continued. That's what we're really after.
So what we could do is just change the word extraordinary to unavoidable in line nine, and otherwise stay with the former language.
Yeah, I don't know about it. Let me ask Ms. Kreider that question. Do you understand what I just said?
I think so. Can I expand upon that
sure.
a little bit? That
sure.
is, do I understand that if the parties or their attorneys have not exercised diligence in preparing their case that we would still have the authority to deny them a postponement?
Yes.
Absolutely. We're interested in where they've done. They have exercised due diligence. They have faithfully represented their clients. They are unavoidably barred from presenting a full case in the first hearing and must ask and are granted something which on its face would be honored as grounds for continuance. That's what we're after.
I have no problem with that at
okay.
all. And I think that Senator Shoemaker makes a good point with respect to the last
the
clause of the proposed amendment.
Well, let's just take extraordinary and put in unavoidable on line 9, except in unavoidable circumstances beyond the control of the requesting party. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Period. And we'll leave the rest the same. All right, thanks. Oh, well, let me ask.
Maybe
she'll
just stay
gonna,
there.
Is that going to result in a different outcome, in your opinion, as far as what would happen with the board and in the minds of the testimony you heard from the representatives of plaintiffs and the other folk who came to talk to us about, especially the plaintiffs' representatives who came to tell us about how absolutely tight-fisted you folk had been over this question and whether this would relax the clenched hand over just a little bit?
It's most of the postponements are actually handled by the referees,
right.
and rarely, if ever, do we have an appeal on that issue. So it's a little difficult for me to know as much as the people who testified to you know about exactly how it's administered. But I understand you to be saying loosen up a little bit, and that can be communicated. And I think what you're also saying, as I understand it, is but continue to try to maintain an approach that does get cases heard promptly.
That's right.
And that doesn't allow postponements willy-nilly. And I think we can be a little more generous and still achieve that objective.
Okay. All right, next.
The deletion of the bolded materials from line 20 through line 28 regards the date at which a worker's disability mm-hmm. would be rated. Heard quite a bit of testimony both from the workers' comp attorneys and the board had concerns about it, although I don't believe they took a position. I'm sure Lynn Marie would give their response to that. But this would restore it so that the rating is done at the time of the hearing and not at the notice of closure.
Okay. I tell you what, why don't we, can we assume that we've adopted the first one then by consensus? Senator Halk, you got the objection to use just going, ditching the boldface material on line on page one and through lines 1 and 4 and 5, 7, 8, and then restore the language.
Are we going back to the same procedure?